What is the biblical expectation of a woman, particularly one who is a wife or a mother? Where do we find positive role models for women in the Bible? And how does her role change with that of the culture surrounding her? And how doesn't it? We're going to start with Proverbs 31 as a staging ground for this conversation, specifically Proverbs 31, verses 10 through 31. This conclusion to Proverbs is an abecedarius. Each line starts with the next letter in the Hebrew alphabet. And just as rhyme can be a mnemonic device, so an abecedarius can be a mnemonic device. Well, at least if you know the language. That's not particularly helpful for us who, if we only speak English, to go, oh yeah, that starts with Aleph and that one starts with Beit, you know, and that one starts with Gimel. So let's start. Proverbs 31, verse 10. There we go, we're almost there. Proverbs 31, starting in verse 10. Who can find a capable wife? Her value is far beyond that of pearls. Her husband trusts her from his heart, and she will prove a great asset to him. She works to bring him good, not harm, all the days of her life. She procures a supply of wool and flax and works with willing hands. She is like those merchant vessels bringing her food from far away. It's still dark when she rises to give food to her household and orders to the young women serving her. She considers a field, then buys it, and from her earnings she plants a vineyard. She gathers her strength around her and throws herself into her work. She sees that her business affairs go well. Her lamp stays lit at night. She puts her hands to the staff with the flax. Her hands hold the spinning rod. She reaches out to embrace the poor and opens her arms to the needy. When it snows, she has no fear for her household, since all of them are doubly clothed. She makes her own quilts. She is clothed in fine linen and purple. Her husband is known at the city gates when he sits with the leaders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them. She supplies the merchants with sashes. Clothed in strength and dignity, she can laugh at the days to come. When she opens her mouth, she speaks wisely. On her tongue is loving instruction. She watches how things go in her house, not eating the bread of idleness. Her children arise and they make her happy. Her husband, too, as he praises her, many women have done wonderful things, but you surpass them all. Charm can lie, beauty can vanish, but a woman who fears the Lord should be praised. Give her a share in what she produces. Let her works speak her praises at the city gates. Who can find a capable wife? Her value is far beyond that of pearls. This is Lemuel's vision of an ideal woman, and you are fortunate just to have met her. I notice that Lemuel never remarks on her physical beauty. He is entirely taken with the beauty of her soul and her character. Now, what does your Bible use here in verse 10? Is she virtuous? Worthy, capable, excellent, noble? This word, chayil, this is Strong's Hebrew word 2426, is used for wealth, valor, virtue, and strength. It's translated in modern Hebrew as soldier. And I noticed that it's actually a compound noun. This is not Isha Chayil, a strong or soldier woman. This is Eshet Chayil. It's a compound word like you would to say a strong man. This is a strong woman or a soldier woman or a virtue woman. It's a compound noun. It's inseparable. Would we use this word for Rebecca? Let's turn to Genesis 24, where we meet Rebecca. Genesis 24, starting in verse 11. There we are. Genesis 24:11. Toward evening, when the women go out to draw water, Abraham's servant had the camels kneel down outside the city by the well. Let's skip to verse 15. Before he had finished speaking, Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abraham's brother, came out with her jug on her shoulder. The girl was very beautiful, a virgin, never having had sexual relations with any man. She went down to the spring, filled her jug, and came up. The servant ran to meet her and said, "Please, give me a sip of water from your jug to drink." "Drink, my lord," she replied, and immediately lowered her jug onto her arm and let him drink. When she was through letting him drink, she said, "I will also draw water for your camels until they have drunk their fill." She quickly emptied her jug into the trough, then ran again to the well to draw water, and kept on drawing water for all his camels. The man gazed at her in silence, waiting to find out whether the Lord had made his trip successful or not. What a demonstration of strength and stamina. It appears that Rebekah is doing this task alone, running back and forth to the well, drawing enough water to sate all his camels. Evening is approaching, so she isn't doing this in the heat of the day, but it's a feat nonetheless. But of course, physical strength isn't the only type of strength we see modeled by women in the Bible. Let's turn to 1 Kings 1. In 1 Kings 1, starting in verse 15, 1 Kings 1, starting in verse 15, Bathsheba went into the king in his room. The king was very old, and Abishag the Shunammite was in attendance on the king. Bathsheba bowed, prostrating herself to the king, and the king asked, "What do you want?" She answered him, "My lord, you swore by the Lord your God to your servant, your son Solomon will be king after me. He will sit on my throne. But now here is Adonijah ruling as king, and you, my lord the king, don't know anything about it. He has killed oxen, fattened calves, and sheep in great numbers, and he has summoned all the sons of the king. Eviatar the priest, Yoav the commander of the army, but he didn't summon Solomon your servant. As for you, my lord the king, all Israel is watching you. They are waiting for you to tell them who is to sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. If you don't, then when my lord the king sleeps with his ancestors, I and my son Solomon will be considered criminals." Bathsheba fights for David to keep his promise to raise her son Solomon to the throne. When we look at verses 13 through 18 of Proverbs 31, we see her described as independent. She buys raw goods and sells refined goods. She buys land and makes it profitable. She is literate, numerate, and acuminate. Acuminate? What does that mean? If you look it up in a dictionary, it says tapering gradually to a sharp point. And here perhaps I'm coining it figuratively as an adjectival form of acumen, quickness, accuracy, and keenness of judgment. She's sharp. She's witty. She's discerning. She's savvy. Let's start with cunning. Where do we see women of the Bible illustrate cunning for a good cause? Rebekah plays her part in helping Jacob take the birthright. Rahab models cunning when she hides the spies in Jericho and sends the king's messengers on a wild goose chase. Jael tricks Sisera when he is fleeing Deborah and Barak. And Michal saves David and deceives the men sent to kill him. What about Shifra and Puah? Let's turn to their story in Exodus 1. Exodus 1, starting in verse 15. Moreover, The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was called Shifra and the other Puah. When you attend the Hebrew women and see them giving birth, he said, if it's a boy, kill him. But if it's a girl, let her live. However, the midwives were God-fearing women, so they didn't do as the king of Egypt ordered, but let the boys live. The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and demanded of them, why have you done this and let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, it's because the Hebrew women aren't like the Egyptian women. They go into labor and give birth before the midwife arrives. Therefore, God prospered the midwives, and the people continued to multiply and grow very powerful. Indeed, because the midwives feared God, he made them founders of families. These two women lied to Pharaoh's face in an effort to save the Hebrew children. Did God punish them for lying? This lie saved many Hebrew children, and God prospered them for it. Given what we've been taught of ancient societies and cultures, a literate, numerate, acuminate woman in such a culture conjures cognitive dissonance, no? Certainly the Bible doesn't frown on a woman making refined goods at home and teaching her children to do the same. Indeed, Exodus 35 mentions women contributing their spinning and weaving skills to the construction of the tabernacle. Lemuel's ideal woman works both wool and flax, different materials with different qualities and purposes. Wool is used to make warm winter clothes, while flax, the key ingredient for linen, as is a favorite of our brethren from New Orleans, makes cooler summer clothes. Does the law forbid a woman working outside the home? Does the Bible frown on a woman conducting business? I certainly didn't see anything like that in the law. Now, if you've seen something like that in the Bible, let me know, and I'll hear you out. At least Lemuel praises her for being industrious and independent, capable of managing her own and the whole family's business. He draws a picture of her girding herself up with strength. Picture yourself wearing clothing typical of the time, pulling the front through the back and tucking it into your belt. Now your legs are unhindered and you can work. So I talked about biblical economics in my last message, the three pilgrimage feasts. These are an economic blessing for Israel, a time for people to bring not only their tithe, but also their excess to buy and to sell, just as the husband may work all season to bring in food, so the industrious, independent wife is encouraged to use her hands to make clothing, wine, or whatever she is led to produce. Both husband and wife may make enough to sustain and provide for the family. Perhaps both even provide excess to sell in Jerusalem or donate to someone in need. Man shall not live on bread alone, so a family needs more than bread to survive. Whatever you're raising, whether it be wheat, flax, cattle, or sheep, you need excess to trade for everything else you need. This scripture pictures a woman capable and skilled, numerate, acuminate, at trade, providing her family with all they need, not just to survive, but to thrive. She purchases raw goods and sells refined goods. She trades with the merchants to provide her family with a wide variety of food and other goods. The farmer gets up at the crack of dawn to work in the field, and this proverbial wife is already up to greet him with breakfast. What a wonderful thing to start the day together with a loving spouse. Look at how they interact. Never does it indicate that he takes her for granted. No, he trusts her from his heart and praises her. Perhaps words of affirmation aren't your love language, but I think we can extend this as appropriate. What are the roles of the husband and wife? This perhaps places him in charge of the field and as the representative to the community, while she is minding the checkbook, buying and selling, raising the children, managing the servants. Must the labor be divided this way? The law doesn't command such. These are all critical tasks, and the labor may be divided as they see fit. Note that she is able to purchase a field with her own income. This also may stir up some cognitive dissonance. Women don't usually inherit property. Why would she be able to purchase it? Why don't women usually inherit property? When a man died and all his children were daughters, as happened with Zelophehad in Numbers 27, the daughters were obligated to marry within the tribe so the land would stay with the tribe. By not extending land inheritance to the daughters, God allowed the daughters to intermarry between the tribes and prevent inbreeding. Where would she have gotten the seed money? By and large, women don't inherit property from their husbands or fathers. Recognizing this, Jewish rabbis encouraged fathers to give their daughters and wives generous gifts. For instance, when the bride's father received the bride price, they encouraged him to grow that money and gift it to his daughter later. Similarly, he was to give the new husband and wife a generous dowry. A fiscally responsible wife would put these gifts to work. Let's look at this in Judges. Let's turn to Judges 1. Judges 1, verse 10. Judah also attacked the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiriat Arba, and they overpowered Sheshai, Achiman, and Talmai. From there they attacked the inhabitants of Debir, which was formerly called Kiriat Sefer. Caleb said, "To whoever overpowers Kiriat Sefer and captures it, I will give my daughter Achsa as his wife." Otniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it. So he gave him Achsa, his daughter, as his wife. And after becoming his wife, she persuaded him to ask her father to give them a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, "What do you want?" She said to him, "Give me a blessing. Since you gave me land in the Negev," which is a desert, "also give me sources of water." So Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. The Bible encourages women to get married and become mothers, just as it encourages men to get married and become fathers. While modern media spurns these values, those who live them report that they are happier and more fulfilled. The General Social Survey is a continuing survey that's been running for over 50 years now. The 2022 data was recently released and collates responses so we can analyze people's relative happiness. And it reports that parents are, on average, happier than non-parents. Married folks are happier than single folks. And the two are cumulative. Married parents are happier than either married non-parents or single parents, and single non-parents are the least happy. Why might this be? We grow when we face and overcome adversity. We have a greater appreciation for that which required a sacrifice of us. A successful, happy marriage is the result of two people making sacrifices for the greater good. Parents sacrifice much for their children and thrill in the growth and achievement of their children. While we may get frustrated at the sacrifices and adversities in the moment, we know that the outcome holds promise enough to make those sacrifices and overcome those adversities. In 2 Corinthians 6, 2 Corinthians 6, verse 14. Paul uses a yoke as a metaphor for marriage. "Do not yoke yourselves together in a team with unbelievers, for how can righteousness and lawlessness be partners? What fellowship does light have with darkness?" What is a yoke? A yoke is a device. The picture I've usually seen has been a wooden device used to distribute work between two animals. Let's borrow Paul's metaphor and extrapolate. A Belgian draft horse is able to pull 2 tons on its own. How much can a fresh pair of Belgian draft horses pull together? You would think, well, 2 plus 2, 4 tons. No. A fresh pair of Belgian draft horses who have never trained together before can pull 8 tons together. A trained pair of Belgian draft horses can pull 16 together. That is the power of two animals equally yoked. And a husband-wife team is similar. It is incredibly wearing to be a single parent. I've seen single fathers and single mothers, and I've experienced secondhand how trying that is. I know some here who have been or are single parents. It is better to be a married parent, but it's still difficult if you're not working as a team. And I've seen this too. The married couple that is aligned, that works as a team, is capable of so much more. They coordinate, they build each other up, they support each other when one is wearing down. When I was being counseled for marriage, my fiancé and I were asked to individually and separately take a survey. I don't remember which survey this is, but I think it was similar to the couple checkup offered by Focus on the Family. Many of the questions focused on how one handles different situations and how one remembers their parents handling similar situations. Why does it matter how our parents handled situations? And we weren't children anymore. I was in my 30s. My fiance Shannon was 8 years my senior and a divorcee. My recollection of how my parents handled things was hazy. Her recollection probably wasn't any clearer, especially since her dad died when she was a teenager. And as happens sometimes, her mother was practically non-functional for several years after. Let's turn to Proverbs 3. While we think about this, Proverbs 3, starting in verse 13. Happy the person who finds wisdom, the person who acquires understanding, for her profit exceeds that of silver. Gaining her is better than gold. She is more precious than pearls. Nothing you want can compare to her. Long life is in her right hand, riches and honor in her left. Her ways are pleasant ways, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who grasp her. Whoever holds fast to her will be made happy. We are not born with wisdom. We are not born with the capacity to face difficult situations, consider our options, and respond appropriately. These are things we are taught. Sometimes explicitly, sometimes by osmosis. People are constantly facing difficult situations, constantly considering their options, constantly responding to these situations. How do we learn to face difficult situations? How do we learn to consider our options? How do we learn to respond? Proximity gives us the answer. Who is our role model? If we grow up with two parents working together, we learn from them. If we grow up with two poorly aligned parents working at odds with each other, we learn from them. If we grow up with a single mother working alone, we learn from her. Maybe you grew up thinking, I don't want to be like my father. Oh, I'll never be like my mother. I'm going to be different. I know I said that. for better or worse. Yet we learn from them. We may consciously walk a different path, but trials and stress undermine our conscious processes, and we respond by instinct, with whatever dwells in the dark corners of our subconscious mind. What lurks in the subconscious? Yes, there we find that which was modeled for us as we were growing up. When we are stressed, our instinctual response is exactly that which we learned from mom and dad. What did that mean for Shannon and me? The two of us had very compatible conscious decision-making patterns. On the other hand, our subconscious responses were polar opposites. When she was upset, she would withdraw, clam up, be a turtle, and lash out if anybody reached out to her. And my instinct was to do just that. Oh, she's holed up in the room. I'm going to go in there and see if I can smooth things over. Yeah, right. That just made it worse. I was so thankful that our marriage counselor explained the results of that survey to us. It took a couple of bad fights and some reflection before I put the pieces together, but thereafter, when Shannon would get upset and withdraw, I was armed with the understanding to fight that instinct. And I knew that it was better not to seek her out and attempt to reconcile immediately, but to give her that space, wait for her to process her thoughts and cool off, and be ready when she came out. Is it wrong to respond as she did? Is it wrong to respond as I did? I don't think that's the case. Our parents were very different. Our situations were very different. As a result, our subconscious responses were very different. But with a bit of wisdom, we learned how to work together and model that love for her son. And Shannon has expressed her thanks several times for being such a positive role model for her son. So whatever your own background or with wisdom, you can be a positive role model for your child. You don't have children? You are a role model for the children in the church too. The proverbial woman is a fount of wisdom, the personification of the first 10 chapters of Proverbs. Surely this shouldn't come as a surprise from a literate, numerate, acuminate woman. Verse 20 here in Proverbs 31, verse 20 extends the love that this ideal woman has for her husband, her children, and her household to the poor and the needy. The capitalist thinks this is frivolous and wasteful, but remember, God constantly commands his people to care for the underprivileged, the widow, the orphan, the Levite, the stranger. Jesus also demonstrated this. Let's look in Matthew 6. And he tells us to remember the less fortunate. Matthew 6, starting in verse 19. Do not store up for yourselves wealth here on earth, where moths and rust destroy and burglars break in and steal. Instead, store up for yourselves wealth in heaven, for where neither moth nor rust destroys, and burglars do not break in or steal. For where your wealth is, there your heart will be also. The eye is the lamp of the body. So if you have a good eye, your whole body will be full of light. But if you have an evil eye, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can be slave to two masters, for either he will hate the first and love the second, or scorn the second and be loyal to the first. You can't be a slave to both God and money. So many translations make it seem like verses 22 and 23 are somehow disconnected from the context. But here's what David Stern wrote in his commentary on this passage. The eye is the lamp of the body. Apparently, Jesus quotes a common proverb and comments on it. If you have a good eye. This is in the Greek text, but the explanation, that is, if you are generous, is added by me, the translator, because in Judaism, having a good eye, an ayin tova, means being generous. And having a bad eye, an ayin ra'a, means being stingy. That this is the correct interpretation is confirmed by the context. Greed and anxiety about money being the topic in both the preceding and following verses. So if we go back and we look at that again, he says, so if you have a good eye, that is, if you are generous, your whole body will be full of light. But if you have an evil eye, if you are stingy, your whole body will be full of darkness. When we become so focused on our personal accumulation of wealth, when we neglect those who are less fortunate, we lose sight of God. The virtuous woman of Proverbs 31 is generous to the underprivileged, and she models this for her children. What is the context of this proverbial woman? When we review Lemuel's description of an ideal woman, do we imagine she was made that way? Perhaps she emerged fully grown, a goddess of beauty and wisdom from the forehead of her father. That isn't the way of things, is it? Lemuel paints the picture of a woman who doesn't need a man, but is happy to dwell with a husband worthy of her. What does Lemuel say of that husband? If you look in verse 23 of Proverbs 31, the leaders of the town trust and respect him, going so far as to allow him to sit with them while they sit in judgment at the gates. Remember the story of Ruth, where Boaz confronts her kinsman redeemer? Like most legal matters, this happened at the city gates in the presence of the city elders. In verses 28 through 29, this husband is generous with his praise of her. Perhaps it is his example that their children are following. Besides these things, perhaps because of these things, we can surely assume that he also is industrious and fiscally responsible. What does that say about her upbringing? Here are those three adjectives again: literate, numerate, and acuminate. She's not afraid to do her math. She's cunning, savvy, discerning. Most people don't come into these on their own. They're raised into them. This implies a father and mother who understood the value of education, who educated her well and encouraged her to be independent. So, mothers and fathers, are you raising your daughters to be literate, numerate, and acuminate? Are you teaching your daughters to be independent? Are you modeling the love of a husband toward his ideal wife? The love of a wife towards her husband? Are you modeling love when life gets stressful? Are you modeling generosity to those who are less fortunate? Sons, are you worthy of such a wife? Are you hardworking? Are you financially, fiscally responsible? Can you seek out and put words to the beauty beneath the skin? Just as Christ protects his bride, are you ready to do the same for her? Just as he provides for his bride, are you ready to do the same for her? And just as he delights his bride, are you ready to do the same for her? Let's finish in Proverbs 8. Proverbs 8, starting in verse 27. Proverbs 8, 27. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew the horizon circle on the deep. When he set the skies above in place. When the fountains of the deep poured forth. When he prescribed boundaries for the sea. so that its water would not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, I was with him as someone he could trust. For me, every day was pure delight as I played in his presence all the time, playing everywhere on his earth and delighting to be with mankind. Therefore, children, listen to me. Happy are those who keep my ways. Hear instruction and grow wise. Do not refuse it. How happy the person who listens to me, who watches daily at my gates and waits outside my doors. For he who finds me finds life and obtains the favor of the Lord.